Hello. All right. So Robbie will be coming in just a minute. He does like to start on time. I got a question about this completion card, which was on the handout from last week that was front and back. I'm going to make more copies of that front and back handout from last week that give you general information about the class, because some people are new today and didn't get it last time, and we ran out of those. So they'll be on the table in the back when you leave, along with homework. So I'm going to always put the homework in the back when you leave. Basically, this does not exactly reflect like the name of the meditation. Just keep track of what you're doing. Use this in general, and I'll update it as we go. And then if you want to earn this beautiful certificate, you can fill out that updated completion card at the end, and then we'll present you with this. But you're more than welcome to just keep track of what you're doing, do it for your own sake, all that kind of stuff. If for streaming and for recording, if you have any questions about something that happens in class that you can't see or whatever, you can email program.db@kadampa-center.org. Any general questions? Okay, I think that's all I have. Okay, you guys know I'm new at this, right? The one more announcement that we try to make every week is just a reminder that we offer these classes for free, meaning that we don't charge for them. However, donations are how we keep the lights on and how we, keep going. So the people that started the center do that for you to practice generosity. So whatever you want to give from your heart is readily accepted. There's a box outside the door where you can put cash or check. And if you ever want to make a donation online, it's pretty easy. Follow prompts, you can find it. But if you have a question, again, you got my email.
I was talking to someone who was out of town today, and they were raving about the streaming of the teaching. So thank you very much to our media team. It's an incredible service to a lot of people. So good evening, everyone. Welcome to the second of six classes in the Discovering Buddhism module, Mind and Its Potential. I'm the course leader, Robbie Watkins. Let's see. Who is here tonight who was not here last week? Got a few people. Okay, so we'll do some reviews. So come on in. You shouldn't be a problem. Who was here last week and is not here tonight? If anybody raises their hand for that one, I'd be very surprised. Okay. I think we actually have more people this time than last time, it looks like. I don't know. If you could do counting, see how many I run away from week to week. That's helpful for me. So this is our second of six classes on Mind and Its Potential, the very first module in the two-year Discovering Buddhism series. And I think it's, I like to think of it as the basis on which all the other modules will be built, in that Buddhism is about working with our mind. And so we first have to understand a little bit about what our mind is. Tonight we're going to start with some of our prayers. We didn't do any last week. If you have in front of you, you can pull out this gold colored book, Essential Buddhist Prayers, and turn to page 34. Yeah, if you're sitting in a chair, it's probably in the pocket in front of you. Everybody got one. And the question when we do prayers in a Buddhist setting, the question is always, who are we praying to, and what's the point of doing them if we've accept that Buddhism is a non-theistic religion or philosophy? Why are we doing prayers? And I'll say that's a question for a Geshe. It's not something I can answer, but it is something to think about. As you notice, in most of these prayers, usually they're in the form of, may this happen. May that happen. It would be great if this happened. You rarely come across a Buddhist prayer that says, dear Buddha, please send me a Cadillac and make it red with a black leather interior or anything like that. And we're specifically not praying to the Buddha, who is a historical figure, a human being like ourselves who achieved enlightenment, which means that he developed his qualities of wisdom and compassion in his own mind completely, but he's not a god that we worship. Geshe Gelug, our resident teacher, frequently says that prayers are aspirations, things that we aspire to. And certainly we can say that we pray because it makes a positive imprint on our own mind stream, an imprint that, if we believe in the laws of karma, will in the future inevitably produce positive results. Now, whether our prayers are going outside ourselves to the enlightened beings, or if they're affecting karma of others, I don't know. I can't answer that. But I personally find it very effective and very useful for me to say these prayers on a regular basis. And the standard ones we typically do are on the top of page 34, what's referred to as refuge and bodhicitta, and then the four immeasurables, then the seven limb prayer, and then the last one is the mandala offering. And over the course of the next, tonight and the next 4 weeks, I'll comment on all of these. Tonight I'll start with refuge and bodhicitta. Starts off, I go for refuge. And refuge is really the first major step on the Buddhist path. And there's a whole module in the Discovering Buddhism series that is about refuge, which means acknowledging what we turn to when things are tough. When we begin to realize that life as we're living it doesn't work out, is not working out. We say that we go for refuge, which is based on, one, a sense that life is problematic, I don't want to continue in this way, and two, I think there is a better place that I can go. And if we're card-carrying Buddhists, that place is the teachings of the Buddha. So we say, I go for refuge until I am enlightened, which acknowledges the fact that all of us have within ourselves the potential to become enlightened, just as the historical Buddha did. He was just another human being, just like ourselves. He was not a god. He had no special qualities. He developed his own mind completely in terms of wisdom and compassion. And we have that same potential ourselves, each of us. So we can become enlightened. So that we say, I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the historical example who gave us the teachings, who showed us the path that we can follow, the Dharma, which in colloquial terms means the teachings that the Buddha gave us. So I go for refuge to the example of the historical Buddha. I go for refuge to his teachings. But there's a very specific definition of Dharma. Does anybody know what the word Dharma means? It's a Sanskrit term. If you translate it into English, what does it mean? Anybody familiar with that? No, it doesn't mean No. What it actually means is that which separates us from suffering. Okay? Dharma is anything that separates us from suffering. But the way we usually use it means the teachings of the historical Buddha, which is what Discovering Buddhism is about. And the Supreme Assembly, sometimes it'll be to the Sangha, but it means other people who are following this path, including those who have brought themselves to a state of enlightenment. Okay? By my practice of giving or generosity, and the other perfections. It says that there's six perfections, and they are patience, generosity, joyful effort, concentration, and a couple others I can't remember right off the bat. But there's six perfections. But by practicing generosity, patience, giving, loving kindness, concentration, may I become a Buddha. Okay. Why do I want to become a Buddha? Not just for my own sake, but to benefit all sentient beings, which means every being that has a consciousness, that has a mind, which refers to animals that we can see, and all those beings who are in the other realms that we talked about last week. Okay? I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So by my practice of giving and other perfections means it's just not going to happen. I have to create the causes to become a Buddha. To become a Buddha, why? So I can benefit all sentient beings. I'm included in that, but so is everyone else. I'm going to become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. And that's what we refer to as bodhicitta, the great mind, the mind of the great wish, the wish to become enlightened to benefit everyone, as opposed to becoming an enlightened just for your own benefit, which is good, but if you include everyone, the people you like, the people you don't like, the people you don't know, that's bodhicitta, that's the great mind. Okay, so we're generating refuge and bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is not the way we normally think, so we have to generate it. We have to force it out. It's a little bit effortful for most of us. Eventually it becomes part of our natural way of thinking, that everything I'm doing is so I can become enlightened for the benefit of others. So that's the first prayer. And traditionally that's said three times. Then we'll do the four immeasurables, which I'll talk about next week, seven limb prayer, and then the mandala offering. And let me just jump over to the mandala offering because people have a lot of questions about that. The mandala offering is we imagine that we are offering everything that's wonderful and great and fantastic to others. Okay, it's an offering. Okay, we're not actually doing it. You don't have to get out your checkbook and write a check when you do a mandala offering. This is something you're imagining. You're creating the mind that is willing to offer to others. So you can offer anything, even if it's not yours. Lama Yeshe, one of my teachers, said, you know, imagine you're offering shopping malls and retail outlets and everything, you know, just more and more stuff. And so there's what's called a hand mudra that we do along with this. It's mudras refer to hand gestures, and they're not that big a deal as far as I'm concerned, but they're, if you want to be an insider in Buddhist circles, it's good to be familiar with one. So when we do the mandala offering, the imaginary offering of everything, we do a mudra, and it's tricky. How many people here know how to do this? Some people, okay, so you get to go walk around and help others do it. It's a depiction of the Buddhist cosmology. We take our two ring fingers, and they point straight up, okay? Then our middle fingers are crossed in front of those, and then our index fingers pull the middle fingers down. It's like that old thing where we're sawing and chopping wood. And then our little fingers are crossed also, and our thumbs are pulling our little fingers down. And what this represents is Mount Meru in the center, our two ring fingers, which is the center of the Buddhist universe, and then the four continents. They thought there were four continents, so the other fingers pull down to the four continents. So it's everything in the world. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Two ring fingers going up, okay? Ring fingers going up, straight up. Middle fingers crossing in front of the ring fingers. Index fingers on top of the ring, middle fingers, pulling them down. Okay, if you got that, you got the... Then you cross the little fingers, and the thumbs pull the little fingers down. I see some very serious faces here. Okay, that's good, yeah. If a couple of y'all could walk around and show it to others, that would help. You want to walk and show people you've got a good one there? Show people your mandala, yeah.
What is the name of it?
You can stand up and, yeah. Yeah, that's good. Okay, yeah, you got it there. Mm-hmm.
What
yeah.
Is the name of it?
It's called a mandala. Okay. Yeah, yeah. A mandala, I mean, there are all sorts of mandalas, okay? Lots of times you'll see people piling up plates. This is a mandala here, okay? Okay. That's good. Yeah, you got it. You got it. Yeah, every yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That one goes over there. Yeah. Yeah. Now put your thumbs on top of those and pull them down. Yeah. That's it. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. No, you can cross as far as I know. Yeah. Okay. That's it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's it. Yeah. Then cross these.
Oh boy.
And then put your thumbs on top of those. Yeah. Good. Okay. The entire universe. Everything you're offering. You can imagine whatever you imagine. Okay. So. At least you're familiar with it, okay? Don't worry if you haven't got it, but it's interesting to know. And then typically at the end of the prayer, you dissolve the mandala. Okay, the mandala represents a perfect universe and you're offering it. So you hold it up in front of you and a little bit elevated like you're offering it. And then at the end, you dissolve it, which means you just turn it in towards you, take your hands apart, and put your palms together at your heart. Okay, so typically we say these prayers with our hands at our heart. That creates some sort of energy, and we have our thumbs touching inside our hands, like that. So we'll start with refuge and bodhicitta three times. And this is an aspiration, as Geshe Gelug says. And then we'll read through the others, even though I haven't discussed them. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Now we'll do the four immeasurables. And these mean immeasurable wishes, immeasurable aspirations. They're so all-encompassing that they can't even be measured. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment, and for friends and hatred for enemies. Now we present, do the seven-limb prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And in that one, when we say, please remain until the end and turn the wheel of Dharma, that's a specific request to those who have achieved enlightenment, to the Buddhas, to stay and teach us what they have realized. Okay, now go into your mandala. We're imagining this is the universe and everything wonderful that it contains. And we're offering it to all sentient beings. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. Imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. And we dissolve it, and there's a mantra we say, Idam Guru Ratna Mandalakam Niryatayami. And I cannot translate that. I'm a big fan of prayers in English, but that one's always said in Tibetan, yeah. Or that's Sanskrit, yeah. Okay. So we've done our prayers. It said we do prayers. Doing prayers is like preparing the ground in which we're going to sow the seeds of our meditation. If the ground is rock hard and untilled, the seeds are sown to no benefit. But it said doing our prayers softens our mind a little bit so that it's better able to do our meditation. So we're going to start with the meditation, a concentration meditation. And we'll begin by checking our posture. We discussed this last time. If you're sitting in a chair, your feet are flat on the floor, or you can put a cushion under your feet. That's not problematic. If you're on the cushion, you're a little bit to the front of the cushion, so your pelvis is opened up. Our back is a little bit straighter than we normally sit, sometimes referred to as a regal posture, or a king-like posture. So not excessively rigid, but a little bit straighter than we normally sit. Our head is straight on our shoulders. Our eyes are either slightly open or lightly closed. Mouth is lightly closed, our jaw is not clenched. Our tongue is against the back of the gum above our upper teeth. Our shoulders are down and back a little bit, so our chest is opened up. Our upper arms are away from our body, and we can either sit with our hands on our knees, or our right hand on left with thumbs touching slightly below the navel. Our legs are in a position that we find comfortable, stable. So we want to have a sense of feeling really rooted or planted. Very solid posture that once established we find non-distracting. So scan your body starting at the top of the head and working down. And if there are any sources of stress or discomfort, address them now, right? So they won't become a distraction during the meditation itself. Okay, thank you. Now that we've established our posture, we're going to take a couple deep breaths so the stomach expands on the in-breath. Our diaphragm is pulled down and our lungs are completely filled. And then on the out-breath, our stomach contracts towards our spine and all the air is forced out. We do that 3 times. And now we allow our breath to return to its normal pattern. We become aware that our mind is a little bit more concentrated, a little bit more focused. We're not spacing out or going blank. We're being more aware than we normally are. And as always, we begin the meditation by setting our motivation. With effort, we generate the bodhicitta motivation, the thought that I am doing this meditation, as simple as it may seem, as insignificant, for the specific intent to become enlightened, for the benefit of all sentient beings. Not just for myself, but for myself, my friends, my family, my coworkers, those people I don't like, those people I don't know, all the beings in the animal realm, and to all the countless beings in the other realms I'm not even aware of. An enormous wish, but so powerful. So just for a moment, generate the bodhicitta motivation. And having generated that motivation, having set our motivation, we begin the actual meditation. The chosen object of concentration, the object of our meditation, is the movement of the breath in and out through our nostrils, the physical sensation of air moving in and out. So just take a minute and just get really clear on what the object is. It's not thinking about the breath. It's not visualizing the breath. It's not counting the breath. It is direct perception of the movement of air in and out through our nostrils, the opening of our nose. So now that we're clear on the object, we begin the meditation. Mind on the breath. Mind perceiving breath. Mind directly aware of breath. Nothing more than that. Simple, direct perception. Non-descriptive. Not describing it, not thinking about it. Direct perception. And every time we notice our breath is on, our mind is on something else, has left the breath, we set aside whatever has distracted us and bring the mind back to the breath. It's as if a child has wandered off the path. We go to them, take them by the hand, and gently lead them back to the path. We're not hard with ourselves, we don't criticize ourselves, but over and over we come back to the breath. And that is the meditation. And we'll end our meditation with a dedication. We acknowledge that we've done something positive, something that makes a positive imprint on our mind stream. And we generate the wish, the aspiration, that that positive imprint not be lost, but may it ripen in the future in a way that will benefit all sentient beings, including ourselves. Any questions or comments on the meditation or on the prayers that we discussed earlier? If you do want to make a question, make sure we use the mic for the millions of people around the world who are listening in. As I said last week, that's what we refer to as a concentration meditation, where we have a very specific object, we keep our mind on it, we come back to it over and over again. Just developing concentration is a virtuous activity. The breath in itself is fairly neutral. We can't become enlightened just by paying attention to our breath. That's not enough. But we can, once we develop that ability to concentrate, we can place our concentration on more virtuous objects like love, kindness, patience, generosity. And as we discussed last week, if we fill our mind with those thoughts, our mind takes on that characteristic. If we think generous thoughts, our mind is generous. We are what we think. There's nothing more to us than the quality of thoughts that come in our mind stream. And the positive message that the Buddha gave us is that we have the ability to change those thoughts. We're not just the victim of random thoughts coming up, which is what it seems like now and what it really is. They're just coming up. We may not want to say victim, but it's very uncontrolled. But the Buddha says it's possible by developing concentration and wisdom to become aware of those thoughts and actually change the thoughts that arise in our mind stream and become totally in control. Not the experience most of us have right now. Okay, Mike over here.
So the homework for last week was to meditate, well, for this course, is to meditate on specific topics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that like studying where you're thinking about all the things you know about that topic?
Well, it said in Buddhism, that's a good question. In Buddhism, they say there are three things we need to do if we want to study Buddhism. One is to study, which means to actually read the text and try and figure out what they're saying and come to the teachings of the teachers. Second is contemplation, which means to think about them in a fairly organized manner, not just to read them, not just to listen to the teachings, but contemplate what they mean. And the third is meditation, where you sit in a very deep, focused, very concentrated way on a specific topic. So we have to do all three.
So I still don't get what, when I'm meditating on one of those topics,
yes.
I'm reviewing in my mind everything I've learned about it.
You can, if you're doing an analytic meditation, as opposed to the simple concentration meditation, where it's just on the breath. If you're doing an analytic meditation on death, for example, the inevitability of death, you may choose that as what you're going to meditate on. And so you... First, you'll start off with some concentration meditation to get your mind to quiet down, become more focused, and then you will concentrate on the inevitability of death using your mind's ability to reason, to remember, to analyze, and that's the object. And every time you wander away from that subject, you start thinking about, where am I going to get gas when I leave the center tonight? I'm sure some people, who else is thinking about that? Yeah. You set that aside, you come back, inevitability of death. Everybody's died. Look at all the people I know who've died. Everybody. So it's again, but you use more than you use your mind's ability to remember and analyze. If you're doing an analytic meditation, now you may just be doing a mantra recitation where you just recite a mantra over and over and over again and you just concentrate on the mantra. Or you may be doing a meditation on the historical Buddha and you just visualize him in front of you and you concentrate on that. So you're not doing the analysis part necessarily. But there's always this concentration of bringing your mind back when it's wandered away. Okay?
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments? Okay, we got one here.
It's actually still on the same exact topic.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, with the homework from last class, it says to review the four characteristics of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
So that'd be so set your motivation, calm your breathing, and then how would you recommend doing that? Because
okay.
I've heard generally, you know, do this with your meditation, but how exactly would you do that?
That's a specific type of analytic meditation, which is called a review meditation. And a lot of people, when they start doing it, it doesn't seem like meditation at all. It just seems like thinking about something, and that's okay. Don't get hung up if it doesn't make you feel all warm all over and it's not a great fuzzy experience. So I asked you to meditate, to do a review meditation on the four characteristics of the mind, and I'm not going to say them because that's part of the next thing we're going to do. So I don't want to give away the answers, but you say, okay, the first one, this is not one of them, but you'd say, the mind is not the brain. I'll just say that was one of them. No, it's not. Then you would just, again, like I say, with awareness of death, you're just like, why is the mind not the brain? Well, if you don't have a brain, can you have a mind? Think about that. Can you have a mind without a brain? Can you have a brain? Blah, blah, blah. Is there anybody who's not had a brain, who had a mind? What do I mean by mind? I mean, you're just very concentratedly, very focused, dealing with that subject, okay, and getting clear in your mind what you mean with those words. And it may seem very much like thinking when you start to do this. Most people have a problem with analytic meditation. And a lot of the Asian traditions, they don't do that, but that's a very characteristic type of meditation in Tibetan Buddhism. Tibetan Buddhism tends to be, as opposed maybe to Zen or something, be a little bit more about thinking and analysis. It's very much an intellectual approach, I think. Not because that's the goal, to have an intellectual understanding, but that's seen as a step to get you to where you have what's called a direct realization, where you can stop the analysis about the inevitability of death. You are just continually aware of that. That has become part of your mind stream, and you no longer have to do that meditation. So the analytic meditations are a way to get to a goal. They're not the end point in and of themselves.
Thank you very much. That was very helpful.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay. So now we're going to do a little bit of a review from last week for those who are here and for those who weren't here. And we need to break up into groups of four, okay? So just organize yourself into groups of four. And if you weren't here last week, you could still be one of the groups of four. And Aaron, if you can help everybody make sure they get into groups. It needs to be four. I got to have four. Okay, sit where you can see each other.
I listened to it.
Oh, that was easy. Okay, class is over. Just wanted to see if you could play with others. Yes, everybody's there. Okay, introduce yourselves and start off, count off 1, 2, 3s, and 4s, okay? Somebody say ones. One. One person in each group say one. One. Twos. Threes. Fours. Okay, everybody got their number. Okay, starting with the ones, introduce yourselves and tell them a little bit about how much you've studied Buddhism, okay, if you're a newcomer or you're if you're already a bodhisattva. Is it too hot, too cold?
I'm freezing.
Oh, okay.
No,
it's 74. Yeah, okay. I think it's too hot. I'm going to turn it down some. Okay, we can wind up the introductions. Okay, so last week we talked about the four characteristics of mind. And I said, if you get nothing out of this module, at least be familiar with those. So we're going to let you teach the other people in your group. We'll start off with the ones. You can explain one of the identify one of the characteristics of mind and explain to the other people in your group what it means to you, or try and give your understanding of it. So, and they don't have to be in the order that I taught them last week. You can grab at anything you can remember. And if you weren't here last week and your number comes up, you can just make something up. Remember, we're talking about mind, consciousness, awareness. So we're going to start number ones. You take it away and start with any concept that you can remember and explain it to your group. And I'm not going to wander around and listen in, so you can make up anything you want to. Okay, so ones, you've got 30 more seconds to finish up. Thank you. Okay, ones, wind it down, and we'll move to number two, the twos, okay? Explain one or the other. Characteristics of mind. You have 2 minutes. Okay, twos, you have 30 more seconds to wind up your explication, your exegesis. Okay, number threes, it's your turn. Number threes, take over. The easy ones have been taken. You only have two left. Choose one. Number threes, explain to your group what one of the characteristics of mind is. Come on, threes, it's getting a little quieter out there. Okay, 30 seconds for the threes to finish up. Okay, and now fours, you get to wind it up. There's only one left, and you need to explain that to your group. The fourth characteristic. The three easy ones have been taken.
That's the pure.
I've become unhooked here. I don't know. I just know it was just dangling. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Okay, time. Bring your discussion to an end. Thank your group members. Okay. If your group got all four, raise your hands. Higher, let me see. Okay. I see some. Okay. Some people are not sure. Okay. Okay. Number ones. And we're going to try and do them in the order that I taught them last week. What's the first characteristic of mind, consciousness, awareness? Not physical. It's non-physical. Completely non-physical. Okay. It is not the brain. It's connected to the brain. It's related to the brain. But it's this completely non-physical awareness that is always there, but we're so familiar with it that sometimes we can't even see it. But it's a non-physical aspect of our being. There's our body, and then there's mind. The body being the physical aspect, the mind being the non-physical aspect. Lots of times you'll hear the term aggregates, and it said that there are five aggregates, four of them which describe various aspects of the body, and one of which is the consciousness. And it said that you can say that we are just a temporary coming together of a body and mind that then separates at the time of death. Or if you want to be a little bit more elaborate, we're a temporarily coming together of the five aggregates that come together to make up something that is, as Lama Zopa says over and over again, merely labeled Robbie. Okay, and that's the only Robbie that exists. The Robbie that is merely labeled onto that temporary association of body and mind. There is no more Robbie that can be found anywhere than the merely labeled Robbie that's placed onto that. Okay, so this is really important. And this is where what we're really talking about when we talk about emptiness, which is one of the last courses in the DB module. But so don't get too hung up on it, but just realize when we're talking about mind, consciousness, awareness, it's the non-physical aspect of our being. Okay, number two is, what did you come up with?
Without beginning, without end.
Okay, yes, uh-huh. No beginning and no end. There is always a previous moment of consciousness. There's always a future moment of consciousness. And we'll talk a little bit more about this tonight. Not just in this lifetime, but the consciousness continues back. We can find no first moment of consciousness. It is a stream, a river of consciousness that is without beginning and that continues in the future and never ends. Without beginning and without end. Okay. But number three is, what did you all come up with?
Clear light.
Clear light, okay. Its nature is clear, pure, empty. Nature is like clear light, which means it has no fixed qualities of its own. Nothing is permanent or unchanging. It is empty space in which thoughts arise. It's like the sky that clouds pass through. The clouds can pass through the sky, but the sky is not the clouds. The clouds are not a permanent, unchanging part of the sky. When we use the word permanent in Buddhism, that refers specifically to something that is unchanging. It doesn't mean without beginning and without end. We wouldn't say the consciousness is permanent, even though it always exists, because it's always changing. But something that's permanent is said to be unchanging. There are very few permanent phenomena, according to Buddhist philosophy. Most things, even though we may not be aware of it, are continually changing. So they're said to be impermanent. Our bodies, certainly, we're aware of how they're changing, okay? My business partner, he's a Buddhist also, and, you know, we joke about, oh, I need to go out and pull those aggregates together a little bit today, you know, go out to the gym and work out or get a haircut. Those aggregates tend to disperse a lot more easily as you get older. You need to aggregate your aggregates a little bit. So the body's impermanent, the mind is impermanent because it's changing continuously. Our thoughts, our feelings, our emotions, they are all impermanent because they're changing. But the nature of the mind itself is like clear light or empty space. Okay? Good. And what was the last one? Number fours. Yeah, its function is to be aware. Yeah. To be aware. That's what the mind does. It is aware. It perceives. Perceives what are referred to as phenomena. Okay? If our mind is, if we perceive loving, kind thoughts, then our mind becomes loving and kind. Okay? The mind has no fixed qualities of its own. All it is a bunch of thoughts arising in that space. So the more loving, kind thoughts that arise, the more loving and kind we are. Okay, so we perceive. The goal of Buddhism, Venerable Rabina says, is just to develop different habits. We want to develop the habit of perceiving thoughts that make us happy, which tend to be love, compassion, generosity, patience, and so on. Okay. Any questions about those? Really, that's what I want you to remember if you don't remember anything else from this class. Okay, wait for the mic.
In the readings, happiness, just looking it up, there's a paragraph where the Dalai Lama says that the mind created itself. It's where he starts introducing this concept of sunyata.
Sunyata, mm-hmm.
Right.
Sunyata, which means emptiness.
Right, and so that kind of, like, if it's beginningless and then saying that the mind created itself kind of...
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good question because that gets into one of the few topics I wanted to talk about tonight, even though we're running out of time. Let's see. Okay, yeah, we're going to go with number two here. When he says the mind creates itself, it's connected with the mind as without beginning and without end. In that, where would you say the mind comes from?
Well, if it's beginningless, it didn't come from anything. I mean,
No. If it's beginningless, that doesn't mean it didn't come from anything.
Oh, so it's...
It came from this moment of mind, came from a previous moment of mind. Came from a previous moment of mind. The mind that I have now was created by my previous mind. By my mind, boom, 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 boom. Okay, the Buddhist point of view is something non-physical cannot have physical causes.
Right.
It has to have similar causes. It has to have non-physical causes. Are you finding the paragraph that you're, yeah, you want to go ahead and read it? Yeah, see if I'm on the...
No, I'm excited.
Yeah, okay, this is the moment, this, my mind that I have right now is a product of my previous mind, okay? It's not a product of what I ate for supper tonight. Okay, it's not a product of the clothes I'm wearing. It's not a product of the car that I drove to Kadampa Center tonight. It is created purely from non-physical causes. Okay, again, the Buddhist point of view, this is where we get in karma. Nothing exists without causes. Nothing is just random. There is a cause for everything. Okay, and we can say it's karma. But the, specifically the cause for what my mind is right now comes from a previous moment of mind. A previous non-physical phenomena causes this moment of mind, and the mind that I have now is going to determine my future mind. So that's, I think that's what he's talking about there. Okay, that the mind is not the product of our father's sperm and our mother's egg coming together. That's physical. That creates our body. It creates our brain. But the non-physical aspect has to come from a non-physical cause. And that is always a previous moment of mind. Okay? Let's see. We got a couple of hands. Let's see. We'll go there and then here.
So the mind is infinite with no beginning and no end. Are there an infinite number of minds, or is there a set number of minds that are always being...
Yeah. Yeah. There are no new consciousnesses being created or destroyed. Okay, if they go on without end, they're not going out of existence, okay? And if they're out without beginning, there could be none that are being created, okay? That would imply a specific beginning point. So the number of consciousnesses in all the realms, not just humans, but animals and other realms that we can't even see, is unchanging. You may say that's permanent. I don't know if that's, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but since the number of consciousnesses, it's infinite, but it's not changing, so that may be a permanent phenomena. I don't know. Okay? Yeah, and they don't merge into some sort of collective consciousness either. My stream, my river of consciousness maintains its integrity throughout endless time. Okay?
So that, and I'll try to keep it in scope because I know it could get out of scope. But we've got this. There is no I. There's a subtle level of most subtle level of consciousness.
I'm going to talk about that in a couple. Okay. Yeah, that's what
that the mind or the I. Then.
I'll talk about that. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Any other comments or questions? Yeah, up here.
The nature of the mind is. The nature of the mind is clear, but the function is to be aware.
Mm-hmm.
Can you be aware and also the mind be clear, or does it?
Well, it's like that's a good question. It's like the mind is a mirror almost, in that the mirror, if you think of a perfect mirror without flaws, has no real qualities of its own. All it does is reflect what's in front of it. So the mind is like a perfect mirror for our for what it perceives. So if it perceives hatred and anger, it reflects those, it is those qualities as long as that's what it perceives. Okay? But when it doesn't perceive those any longer, it no longer has those qualities. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so what we want to do to become a Buddha is to create the karmic causes so that our mind is reflecting nothing but compassion and wisdom without cessation, without gaps, not just intermittently, but that is all that the mind perceives is compassion and wisdom. And the Buddha said that we can do that by working with our own mind so that our mind perceives nothing but compassion, the wish that others be happy, and or the wish that others be free of suffering, and wisdom, an accurate perception of reality. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. Let's see. Okay, go rush through a couple of... I want to just touch on this because you'll hear this referred to, the different levels of consciousness that you brought up. We say the mind is without beginning and without end, but it's said there at least, this is a very simple model. You can find more complex models, but you get more and more complex explanations of things, but they don't, they're not proving that the simpler models are incorrect. They're just not the most refined. So in one model, it says there's three levels of consciousness. The gross, the subtle, these are the English translations and they're so bad, and then the deepest one is the most subtle. Surely they could have come up with something better than that, but that's how it comes. The gross level of consciousness is the one that is functioning most of the time, that says, you know, that perceives I'm here at Kadampa Center and I'm getting bored and I wish he would shut up. And this doesn't have anything to do with my life. I wonder where I'm going to get gas tonight. And, you know, how long is the line going to be? And I got all this stuff to do at work tomorrow and I really like this person and I really don't like that person. And I remember what I had for lunch the other day is very good. This is the way our mind, this is the level that we're functioning at. For most of us, 99% of the time, it's the gross level. It's the conventional level, the level that interacts with the world around us. Okay? The subtle mind is a more delicate perceiver. It doesn't perceive reality directly, but it's a little bit more tuned into things. This is the mind that we experience in our dreams. Okay? We can access this mind in very deep meditation. It's said that when we faint, we're experiencing the subtle mind. And it's said during sexual orgasm, we're experiencing the subtle mind. So it's intuition, okay? When we have an intuitive feeling that's not based on something we can necessarily see, that's the subtle mind. And then the most subtle mind is something most of us have no connection with. It's there. We don't realize it. It's covered up by the gross mind. It's completely obscured. This is the mind that is like clear light. Okay? The gross mind is not like clear light. The gross mind is like a garbage heap. Okay? The subtle mind is like a nice front yard, maybe. The most subtle mind is the clear light mind. Okay? When we die, okay, the mind starts to separate from the consciousness. It's said that the gross mind is absorbed into the subtle mind. And there's an actual meditation where you go rehearse this that will be covered in the death and dying module. And at that point, the subtle mind, after that, is absorbed. And I don't ask me what that word means. It's not like it disappears, but it means it sinks down into the most subtle mind. And at the actual moment of death, when the consciousness completely separates from the body, which according to the Buddhist tradition may not be when you're dead according to Western standards. You know, you may have no heartbeat, you may have no EEG, nothing on your EEG, but according to the consciousness may still be in that body. But at some point, the body and the mind separate. And at that moment, we experience the most subtle mind, the mind of clear light. Most of the time, we're so terrified by the process, we don't even notice that. We're not aware of that. It just goes so fast, and our consciousness rushes into the bardo, which is the in-between realm, where the consciousness starts to look for its next rebirth and all sorts of things happen, they say. But if we are prepared for that, if we practice that, this is a meditation that said His Holiness the Dalai Lama does 4 times a day. We can take advantage of having a direct experience of the most subtle mind, uncontaminated by the gross mind, not even contaminated by the subtle mind, but a direct experience of the mind of clear light. and use that for incredible progress on our spiritual growth if we're prepared for it and we realize it. But this is the mind that continues on into future lifetimes. Okay? This is the mind that carries all the karmic imprints from previous lifetimes. So this mind in the bardo joins up with another body, and the subtle mind and the gross mind start to arise, and we're reborn as a human being or an animal or whatever. Okay? This is the gross mind that, you know, has our memories in it. And, you know, sometimes, particularly in children, some of these memories from previous lifetimes are carried over. Most of us as adults don't have any memory of previous lifetimes. But that's where this stuff dwells, and most of us don't have access to it. Okay, but this is our personality, our likes, dislikes. That is not carried forward into future lives. Even the subtle mind isn't carried forward. It's the most subtle mind, the mind of clear white light with the karmic imprints that goes on. Not our personality and who we are, but a very less personal part of our mind. Any questions or comments about that?
I'm kind of confused on the karmic imprints and the pure clear light. Like if there's this bad negative karma that we carry.
Exactly. Yeah, that's. That? Mm-hmm. It seems like a contradiction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like some baggage that it's carrying. It's not of its nature, but they kind of are. You know, they're kind of freeloaders who ride along with. I can't explain that. That's a good question, and it does seem a little bit of a contradiction. But the imprints are carried by, again, they're not changing the nature of it. It's still clear and white and pure, but it is carrying those karmic imprints. So I can't say any more than that. It's a good question, though. Anyone else? Up over here.
Mm-hmm. Something that is very difficult for me to understand is this mind that travels when I'm going to rebirth,
mm-hmm.
in what moment it enters to my body when I'm a fetus, a sperm, when I have 2 years, when
it says the consciousness joins with the body when the sperm and egg meet.
It's that,
yeah.
The exact
that very moment where the egg, where the sperm fertilizes the egg, that's when the consciousness comes in. It says, okay. Yeah, it says the consciousness enters in that moment.
And it says how? Or
well, it's based on karmic imprints, okay? It said to some degree you're in the bardo and you're choosing your parents. You're choosing what womb you want to be born into, okay, but it's basically under the influence of karma as to where you go.
Okay, but it doesn't say like how, it's like a spirit flying and suddenly...
It's a non-physical phenomena. It's just pure consciousness, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm, yeah, that's all it is. Completely non-physical. Okay, one more and then we're going to do a little bit of meditation.
So if it is completely non-physical, but could it be influenced by physical form, like if you are reborn into a brain that is damaged?
Yeah, that would be the results of the karma that the consciousness is carrying, that it chooses to unite with that egg and sperm, that's going to have a defective rebirth. Okay, it's karma is non-physical also, but it affects everything. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to have to do a very short meditation. I want this to be a long one, but it's okay. So very quickly, just review your posture. A couple deep breaths from the abdomen. And set your motivation for doing the meditation. And having set our motivation, we'll do just a minute of concentration on the breath to allow all the chatter to subside and to bring our mind to a more focused, more concentrated state. And now we're going to do a very brief meditation on the continuity of consciousness. Just using our own experience, we'll look at our mind and see that there was always a previous moment of mind. But there is a continuity, a connection between them. So what my mind is thinking right now is preceded by what I was thinking 15 seconds ago during the motivation, which is connected to what I was thinking at the beginning of the meditation, which is what I was connected to what I was thinking during the discussion, which is connected to what I was thinking during the small groups, which is connected to what I was thinking during the prayers, which is connected to what I was thinking when I entered into Kadampa Center, to what I was thinking this afternoon, to what I was thinking this morning when I woke up, to what I was thinking before I went to bed last night. So just think for a moment and trace your consciousness back. There'll be big gaps that you don't remember, but you know that you had a mind then. You can't remember what it was thinking, but I can't remember what I was thinking yesterday afternoon, but I know I was not unconscious. There was a moment of mind there, and there is a continuity. And we can trace it back to last year, 5 years ago, 20 years ago. Just look at the continuity of thoughts, of awareness, of perceptions. Even with the gaps, we know that there was a continuity. There was never a moment when there was no consciousness. And as we trace it back to our youth, to our childhood, to our infancy, we get to our oldest memory. We can't remember anything prior to that. But we know we had a mind before that. Even though we can't remember it, there was a consciousness there. So we can trace the consciousness back to times that we can't even remember. So what does that imply? What are the implications of this continuity that we can see, both going back and going forward? And our time's up, so do a brief dedication and relax your concentration. That's the meditation I would like you to work with this week, looking at previous moments of consciousness and the continuity. And you have the homework, Aaron? Yeah.
The homework is on the table right back
there. Okay. And I'll see everyone next week. Thank you very much.